From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.
America is finally on the move again.
President Biden addressing today's jobs report that showed 559,000 jobs added in May. That's about double the gains from April. But it is still below expectations, and the economy is still down more than 7 million jobs from before the pandemic. Still, the president is expressing optimism.
Unemployment filings are down. Hunger is down. And vaccinations are up. Jobs are up. Wages are up. Manufacturing is up. Growth is up.
Let's bring in Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, welcome.
Oh, thanks, Peter.
So the Labor Department also reported that the unemployment rate fell below 6% for the first time since the pandemic began. What's your takeaway from this report?
Well, like you said, it is notable that the number was lower than what economists were expecting in general. Our survey at Bloomberg had a median estimate for 675,000 jobs, so more than 100,000 above what we actually saw. But it's still a big gain in jobs. And I think the main takeaway is we can all sort of breathe a sigh of relief that this recovery from the virus is still going pretty strong.
Well, we mentioned that the numbers are much better than they were in April. Why do you think job growth is so different from one month to the next? And what does that say about what's happening with the recovery?
So I think there's two important things. One thing is to always remember that these are estimates, and they're just that. And given all of the dislocation from the virus, it's really hard to make totally precise estimates. I'll give you an example. ADP, the big payroll processing firm, they put out their own jobs numbers, and they saw almost 1 million jobs added last month. So I think you have to sort of squint at these numbers and look for the big trends rather than stare at them too closely for precision. But Peter, the other big thing I'd point out is it's what's known as labor force matching. In other words, there are a lot of job openings out there, actually a record number of more than 8 million. And there are obviously a lot of people looking for jobs, but matching up the openings with the people who want those jobs or are qualified to take those jobs or really in the right location to take the job, that takes time to sort out, and it's not something that can be happen overnight where all these openings get filled. So that's sort of one of the things that's slowing the full recovery from happening as quickly as you might guess.
Okay, and to that point, one of the numbers that struck me in this report is that a little over half of the jobs were added in leisure and hospitality, most in the food service and drinking industry. And on Monday, I spoke with Jessica Parkinson. She's the co-owner of the restaurant Salt in Ohio. She told me that she's having a really hard time finding workers. Here's what she said.
I've been washing dishes for the last 7 months. Serving-wise, we had almost 90 covers last night with three servers that had to keep the patio closed because I didn't have enough staff to be outside and inside at the same time.
So despite some really positive hiring in the restaurant industry last month, there still is a huge need out there. What should we know about the restaurant industry?
Well, I think that job growth and your example, the anecdote about people having a hard time getting the employees, it does show that this industry, and it's a very important industry in this country, Peter, a lot of jobs in restaurants and bars and hospitality, it's recovering very well. People are vaccinated. They're more comfortable going out again. The warm weather, this outdoor dining boom is continuing. But I think that industry is still very far away from a full recovery. So it's going to take a little bit longer to get that back on track.
And in about 30 seconds, can you give us a little headline on wages? What happened last month?
So wages were up about 15 cents an hour. They're going up. It's another one of those numbers that's sort of hard to put too much precision on because it depends on the makeup of the jobs that are being added. And it's a number that can vary from month to month. But it's a good sign to see them going up, obviously.
All right. Michael Regan, senior editor, Bloomberg News. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
From the moment he took office in May of last year, Louis DeJoy's decisions as Postmaster General have been marred by controversy. He slashed budgets, cutting overtime for mail carriers, and he was accused of slowing down service as millions of Americans were voting by mail in the 2020 election. Well, now the FBI is investigating allegations of campaign finance violations, specifically political campaign donations made by employees at DeJoy's former company. These donations were part of the subject of a Washington Post investigation back in September. And Amy Gartner, national political reporter for the Washington Post, is one of the reporters who worked on that investigation. And she joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. You spoke with people who worked at DeJoy's former company, New Breed Logistics, based in North Carolina. What did they tell you?
I and my colleague spoke to five different former employees who said that they were urged by either Louis DeJoy's aides or by DeJoy himself to write checks and attend fundraisers for Republican candidates. And then two employees told us, who had direct knowledge of the company's financial and payroll systems, said that DeJoy would instruct that bonus payments to staffers be boosted to help defray the cost of their contributions, which is illegal.
Explain more on why this is illegal and why the FBI is looking into this.
Sure. It's what's known in campaign finance universe as a straw donor scheme. It's illegal under North Carolina law if it's done on behalf of a state candidate, and it's illegal under federal law if it's done on behalf of a federal candidate. And these donations went to both state candidates and federal candidates. And so basically the way a straw donor works, my colleague Jacob Bogage described it really aptly as sort of like when you ask your older sister to go buy you a six-pack of beer because you're not old enough to do so, and she is. So you're effectively hiding the fact that you're exceeding the campaign contribution limits that are set in law.
Okay, DeJoy was asked about this by Democratic Representative Jim Cooper at the House Oversight Committee hearing back in August. Let's listen.
Did you pay back several of your top executives for contributing to Trump's campaign by bonusing or rewarding them?
That's an outrageous claim, sir, and I resent it.
I'm just asking a question.
The answer is no.
Okay, DeJoy denies doing anything wrong, but after your Washington Post investigation came out, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform began an inquiry into whether DeJoy may have actually lied under oath when he made that denial. How significant is it that the FBI has taken up this investigation?
It's actually not uncommon for the FBI to use media reports on campaign finance alleged wrongdoing to launch criminal investigations. This is a pretty right out of the playbook example, allegedly, of a straw donor scheme. So it's not actually surprising that the Justice Department is looking into it. One thing that I will say about that hearing that you mentioned is that the questioner, Representative Cooper, made a little bit of a unforced error in the way that he asked that question, because he asked Mr. DeJoy specifically if he had encouraged illegal contributions to President Trump. And our investigation focused on contributions prior to 2015. So it's possible that Mr. DeJoy was telling the truth. If it's true that he encouraged the straw donor scheme in prior elections for different candidates, his outrage is a little bit disingenuous in that clip. But we don't know if he did similar straw donor scheming allegedly for President Trump. We do know that the statute of limitations has expired. It's 5 years on those prior campaigns. So it would stand to reason that the FBI is looking into whether Mr. DeJoy also made similar efforts for Trump. And we also know from research done by the Campaign Legal Center that there are very similar patterns in the case of donations to President Trump. In other words, employees giving the same amounts on the same day, which is similar to the patterns that we discovered for some of those prior candidates. And so it stands to reason that the FBI is looking into that as well, although it's worth noting that a pattern is not evidence of a straw donor scheme. There needs to be more than just a pattern. There needs to be evidence that he asked or encouraged his employees to do it and reimbursed them.
DeJoy has had a very rocky tenure as Postmaster General, as I mentioned, and his position as a major Republican fundraiser has been an issue for many Democrats for a while now. What does this latest investigation mean really for the U.S. Postal Service and his position as Postmaster General going forward?
It's an excellent question, and I don't think we fully know the answer yet. Mr. DeJoy serves at the will of the governing board of the Postal Service. The board under President Trump made clear that they supported Mr. DeJoy unequivocally. But now we've got some change in leadership on that governing board, and so it's not clear what will happen. Certainly, a criminal investigation is not helpful to his tenure at the Postal Service. I think we will certainly see more discussion about what the future trajectory of that tenure will be in the coming days.
Amy Gartner is national political reporter for The Washington Post. Amy, thank you so much for your reporting.
My pleasure.
There are two times in our country's history when the government saw the mistreatment of Black Americans as something we could no longer tolerate. The first was after the Civil War. The second was the Civil Rights Movement, both known as Reconstruction. For years, Reverend William Barber has been calling for a third Reconstruction, a sweeping effort from the federal government to dismantle racist policies and structures, to reimagine our society for the betterment of us all. And this idea has gained traction over the last year. Reverend Barber is the co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, president of Repairers of the Breach, and author of the book, The Third Reconstruction, How a Moral Movement is Overcoming the Politics of Division and Fear. And he joins us now by Skype. Reverend Barber, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me on today.
Thank you for being here. You know, Reverend, I've heard you say that the real question we need to be asking ourselves is what is the cost of inequality? And this is the basis for your call for another Reconstruction. Say more.
When we look at where we are today, what is it costing us in America to have 140 million poor and low wealth people in this, the richest nation in the world, in the country today? What is it costing us to have 43% of the nation, Black, white, brown, Asian, indigenous, to be poor and low wealth?
And you say there's not a scarcity of resources, but a scarcity of social justice conscience. Can you explain what you mean?
Yeah, there's not a scarcity of resources or a scarcity of ideas. We know that people either uninsured or underinsured. We have the resources to insure them. And if we insured them, that investment would actually lift America. It would not hurt it any further. We know every time corporations want money, they get the tax cuts, but poor and low wealth people get the short end of the stick, and it's hurting this nation. So there's not a scarcity of resources or a scarcity of ideas. There's a scarcity of political consciousness, the will, and our campaign is saying that stops now with us.
Well, let's talk about what this can look like, because you say this is more than any single bill or agenda or political power. But we are seeing elements of what you're pushing for now with some of the Biden administration's most recent measures taking on systemic ills. Do you think that the administration is getting off to a decent start in what you're asking for?
Sure, it's a better start. And in fact, we met with the policy team of the president before the inauguration. We took 35 people into that meeting, mostly poor and low-wealth people, public health specialists, environmentalists, economists, and lawyers. And we laid out what we call a 14-point plan for the healing of the nation. And we argued that you can't heal the nation unless you establish justice. The Constitution says that. So we said healing couldn't just be people being nice in their rhetoric. It had to be a real shift in public policy. Number one, we needed living wages. We needed healthcare for all. We need infrastructure that's targeted toward poor and low wealth communities and infrastructure that addresses climate change. We said we needed restoration of the Voting Rights Act. So when we see those things being put forward in the House and pushed by the president, we are glad to see it. Now, the question, however, is getting them pushed all the way to policy and at a high enough level. We are deeply concerned when there are those that don't even want, for instance, the president's infrastructure bill. And we believe even at the amount that it's at, it's not fully enough.
Well, you're working with Democratic Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal of Washington State and Barbara Lee of California to pass a resolution that would realize at least one goal of the third reconstruction, which is to end poverty in America. How will it do so?
What is significant about this bill, the resolution says to Congress and to America, here are the things we must do, all of them, and why. And if we do these kinds of investments, even if it requires some deficit spending, we will benefit more on the back end. We must change how we measure poverty. We must have a living wage. We must have universal health care, earned income tax credit, child tax credit, not on a temporary basis, but on a permanent basis. We have to repeal the Trump tax cuts and make corporations pay their fair share. And if we do this, yes, it would in fact fully address poverty, end poverty and low wages in this country.
You know, you talk a lot about government actions, but what role does the private sector play? I'm asking you this because there's this situation with Walmart, the Employee Safety and Wages Initiative that Walmart just voted against. The company says it wasn't necessary to take on because it already has proper health protocols and offers workers 2 weeks paid leave for COVID-related reasons. What does Walmart's decision indicate for you? And do you think that private companies play a role in what you're pushing for?
Well, it proves to us, again, why we need a reconstruction and why we need a policy shift. We would hope that corporations would just do the right thing because it's smart, it's economically sane to pay your workers a living wage and to make sure they have health care and to make sure they're protected. But if they won't do that, then we need to have federal laws. As Dr. King said, a law may not make you love me, but it could keep you from lynching me, or it can keep you from paying me less than I deserve. But now I will say we have a number of corporations in the restaurant and hospitality arena, and they are joining the call for a $15 minimum wage across the board in this country. It's shameful what Walmart is doing, the amount of money that they're making, because in many cases during this pandemic, the poor and low-wealth people were the first to have to go back to work to help the rest of us, so-called essential workers, but they were the first to get infected, the first to get sick, and the first to die, but they're the last people that are getting relief. We must address this hypocrisy. And so corporations have to recognize it is to your disadvantage to live in a nation where 43% of the people are poor and low-wealth, and it's rising. It's economically insane. Is constitutionally inconsistent, and is morally indefensible.
I want to go back to what we were talking about regarding Congress. You know, one major part of all of this is that it needs bipartisan support, and we're deeply divided right now. I mean, does that concern you?
Well, greatly. And let's just be honest. We've always been deeply divided on these issues. When it comes to addressing systemic racism in all of its forms, we are willing to mobilize in the street and mobilize in the court and mobilize at the ballot box. The division is there because the aristocracy and the ruling class, as Dr. King said, has always feared poor and low wealth people of every race coming together, using their power to vote in a way that changes who gets in office and then changes the economic architecture of this nation. We believe we can change the consciousness of the country. And we know now in 15 states in this country, we did a study with Columbia University, if poor and low wealth people vote between 1 and 25% in 15 states, that vote can fundamentally change who sits in office. And Reconstruction is that as well. It's not just policy. It's a change in political activism and a commitment of the people.
Well, speaking of that, you know, something I was really struck by in your op-ed piece in the New York Times, is that you remind us that the generation of kids who watched the case of the shooting death of Trayvon Martin in 2012 are now adults, and, and they're the ones who are mobilizing. This week, we've been reflecting on the Tulsa race massacre in which Black people who were able to build wealth and thrive were targeted and killed. In this effort, how do you ensure its longevity?
You know, that is a powerful question, and the question of longevity is both a commitment to the longevity, but we can't wait another 15 or 20 years. This democracy, I believe, will implode. You can't have nearly 50% of your people in poverty and low wealth. The question now for America is not whether Democrats can survive or Republicans survive. Can America be? And so how do we do it? First of all, you have to build from the bottom up, from the states up. Secondly, you have to build fusion coalitions. That means black and white and brown. You can't have coalitions up, just we're going to fight. Black folk over here fighting for voting rights, white people over here fighting against environmental injustice. They all intersect, and we must deal with interlocking injustices with an intersectional moral fusion coalition. And you know, it's working. Last year on June 20th, we were supposed to have a mass poor people's assembly moral march on Washington, and we couldn't because of COVID. So we did it virtually, and 2.7 million people viewed and showed up and said, it is time for this fusion coalition. And guess what? It's always been a fusion coalition. It was Frederick Douglass, who was black, and William Lloyd Garrison, who was white. It was Dr. King, who was black, and it was Jewish rabbis and Viola Woosa and others who were white. That's what is critical in this moment for a long-term fight. But it can't be too long, because if we don't get a handle on the issues of systemic racism, systemic poverty, ecological devastation, denial of health care, and this false moral narrative of white supremacy and religious nationalism, it will undermine this democracy in ways that may not be able to be fixed. The reconstruction must be now.
Reverend William Barber is co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign and president of the Repairers of the Breach. Reverend, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. God bless you. Take care.
What happens to police officers who get caught stealing, lying, or tampering with evidence? Each week, we open up an internal affairs investigation that used to be secret to find out how well the police police themselves. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
On Sunday, Mexicans will go to the polls in an election that's been one of the bloodiest the country has ever seen. More than 80 candidates have been murdered since last September. In the capital, there's a local race that will elect someone to a brand new office to represent migrant interests in Mexico City's Congress. Tens of thousands of migrants living abroad will cast votes. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Rodrigo Cervantes reports.
This year's midterm elections in Mexico are played with interesting characters. In the state of Sonora, a social media influencer runs for Congress, while in neighboring Baja California, Mexico's first Miss Universe wants to be governor.
First runner-up is Miss Netherlands. Miss Universe is Mexico, Lupita Jones!
In Mexico City, a legendary masked wrestler wants to become district mayor.
Aparece el gigante sabio y niebla!
And the former singer of the acclaimed cumbia band Los Angeles Azules also runs for district mayor. There's also a first-of-a-kind position on the ballot this year, and the office is expected to give voice to millions of Mexico City natives living outside of Mexico, a migrant congressperson. José Antonio Carrera is a former advisor for Mexico City's Electoral Institute and expert in migrant political and voting rights. He says the post is a local congressional seat that Mexico City's government and electoral authorities promoted, along with immigrant lobby groups after the 2014 electoral reform. Carrera says Mexico is fundamentally a migrant country with about 13 million Mexicans living overseas, almost all of them in the U.S., and that's not counting the 25 million second- and third-generation Mexican-Americans who are also eligible to vote. According to the Electoral Institute, only 34,000 Mexicans living in 92 different countries registered to vote for the election, 25,000 of them from the U.S. For Carrera, the numbers are surprisingly low considering the large amount of Mexican migrants. And for most of the second or third generation Mexicans living overseas, their political priority is not Mexico. Migrant voters will choose a representative from 11 candidates, most of them living in the U.S. But no matter who they pick, Sergio Bárcena says there's a problem.
There's still a lot of uncertainty of how this is going to work, because the inner rules of the Chamber of Mexico City have not yet been modified.
Bárcena is a researcher from Tec de Monterrey in Mexico City, specializing in congressional politics and elections. He says Mexico City's migrant representative has no clear terms for his or her duties. He says there's not a single law yet to define the role, let alone the salary, or if their participation will be online or in person.
You may think this is a very avant-garde reform, people that's representing migrants. However, not all migrants are the same. They have very different concerns, a migrant from the U.S. and a migrant from Europe. And also, these people are not attached to the life here in Mexico City, and they don't know the problems that are going on here in Mexico City.
Bárcena says the migrant congressperson will most likely present laws on remittances regulations and on how the city protects its migrants overseas, but they have no way to influence immigration policies in other countries. The researcher says that the migrant representative will hardly have an impact on the balance of power in the city's Congress, but the position will at least represent an important shift in symbolic terms. For Here and Now, I'm Rodrigo Cervantes in Mexico City.
Even the most casual sports fan knows that pre- and post-game press conferences are just as much a part of the spectacle of sports as the game itself, which is why tennis star Naomi Osaka's decision earlier this week to skip a post-game conference after the French Open and later drop out of the contest has sparked two major conversations about the role and relevance of the press conference and the importance of prioritizing mental health. We're joined now to talk about all of this for our sports roundtable with Amira Rose Davis, a professor at Penn State University whose work focuses on the role of race and gender in sports, and Mike Florio, a sports commentator who writes for Pro Football Talk on NBCSports.com. Welcome to you both.
Hello, great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, historically, the purpose of the presser in sports is to grow the league and gain fans and sponsors. And Mike, you recently wrote that you used to think that speaking to reporters was actually a small price to pay for getting paid so much money to play the sport. But your views have changed, especially because we have social media now. Can you say more?
There are so many ways that players can communicate with fans and provide access to fans. And for decades, the sports reporter was the conduit between player and fan. And back in the days when the NFL wasn't nearly as popular as it is now, there was a greater urgency to entice reporters to pay attention, to listen, to write and talk about the National Football League. That's just not the case anymore. And when it comes to the mandatory post-game press conference, I think that it's reasonable to at least raise the question, given today's climate, given the different ways that access can be had. Is there a balance to be struck between forcing players to speak when maybe they don't want to and preserving and protecting and respecting their mental health?
Well, let's bring in Amira Rose. You've actually also been interrogating this idea of reporter access. It's an interesting idea to take on because if the reason for pressers is economics versus gaining information, has the role of the press conference outlived its function? What do you think could be the alternative?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really fruitful question and one that we've seen. But I also think there's a little bit of a disparity in who's having these conversations. As somebody who's sports media adjacent, of course, I host a sports podcast. You know, I found that the conversation is really about, like, what do sporting futures look like? And sometimes we're so ingrained with how it's been that it's hard to imagine new ideas or new ways of doing things. And I think that this is one area, to Mike's point, where we've seen social media, we've seen things like the Players Tribune, where athletes are writing their own, penning their own kind of commentary or pieces. We've seen podcasts, we've seen, you know, a variety of ways that the way of the landscape of sports media has shifted. And I think that it's really great to have an opportunity to say,
Is there a way that we can actually think about what narratives we tell around sports, or who's doing the storytelling, and what is the function of that? And if it's not about economics, is there something else we can pair it with?
You also study the role of race and gender in sports. We've seen many other sports figures protest in their own way. The press conference, Marshawn Lynch, for example, answering every question with, "I'm just here so I won't get fined." Put this into context for us. This is an extra layer of complexity in this conversation. Osaka is a woman. She's also Asian and Black.
One of the things that's very clear is that there's a disparity, and there has long been a disparity, between the demographics of many of the athletes being covered, especially when you're talking about, obviously, the NFL, when you're talking about the way that Serena and Venus Williams have been covered, what it means for Naomi Osaka to be covered by a tennis, you know, media that is overwhelmingly older and white and male. And I think that these differences are also a part of the puzzle, right? Because there has been the same conversations within sports media of how do we get those newsrooms to reflect not only the demographics of the athletes and the sports being covered, but just a wider variety of voices in there. And I think sometimes that particular, you know, feature of it is what has made the disconnect or the hostility between the athlete and the reporter that much more palpable, because it feels like you're just an entertainer. You're there and all these people have microphones in your face and you don't see yourself reflected in the questions or in the framing or in who's doing the reporting. And I think that that has been something that many athletes have articulated and picked on about that adds to their, you know, hesitancy or discomfort.
Mike, you write that reporters who cover the NFL have actually in recent years become more sensitive to the mental health of players. But there's a caveat here that the sensitivity to mental health is only applicable if it doesn't threaten media access. What balance needs to be struck here?
There needs to be a balance. And before we can strike the balance, we need to have reporters who are willing to potentially alter in some way their own access. And I feel like many reporters don't even want to have that conversation. I have had some react to me negatively, some in hostile fashion over the...
What have they said to you?
Well, just the idea that anything that limits the ability of the reporters to cover the sport is a negative, is in some way an impairment on that job that reporters fill as the conduit between the fans and the people who play the games. And I understand that. Look, no one wants to have their ox gored. No one wants to have their job become more difficult than it is. And I'm not suggesting that locker room access should be eliminated. All I've suggested is, why don't we make this currently mandatory practice of showing up for press conferences and speaking, why don't we make that voluntary? And frankly, it isn't mandatory to speak. You can say, "I'm just here so I don't get fined," over and over again. You can give non-responsive answers if you're an NFL player. You don't have to say things that respond to the questions. You just have to show up. That's one of the things about it that bothers me. There's just this knee-jerk, thou shalt show up, with no expectation that anybody's actually going to say anything. You just have to show up.
And to be clear, like, this idea that, like, we need to do better at taking mental health seriously goes beyond sports. As a society, we've started to talk about caring about mental health, but the rhetoric hasn't necessarily caught up with what it looks like to actually build that into our structure of society. And especially in a field like sports landscape, where we're really tied to narratives, we've seen over and over again where we have no problem talking about mental health or talking about mental toughness or talking about these things. When Brett Favre has a tremendous game after his dad passes away, Carl Anthony Towns, right? How many close-ups of him crying or being consoled with a graphic about how many family members he lost to COVID did we see over the last year? We were talking and well aware of the mental anguish that was there, but it becomes a narrative. And I think that there's a way in which we stop and we talk stories and we tell stories about the strength of that and never stop to ask why we require that strength in the first place. And so I think that we're at actually this moment where I obviously study sports because I find a lot of power in them. And part of your answer to your earlier question of what might the future look like, I'm like, what would it look like for sports to really take a leadership role in saying, actually, this is what it looks like to not only talk about mental health, but to take it seriously. And if that means we say, hey, having a mandated presser where you might be at the lowest of lows and right after have to try to explain it in something that we all know is not necessarily useful, what are other possibilities that we can still think about access and telling those stories that don't involve them doing it in a way that might seem harmful to an athlete?
You know, Amira Rose, your point about what this larger message about mental health, we're seeing so much outpour from this. There was this note from actor Will Smith to Naomi Osaka saying they were wrong. It's now gone viral. Others have also weighed in. Calm, this meditation app, is now offering to pay fines for players who decline media. Where do you think this moment is taking us? I know both of you have laid out what should happen, but what do you think will actually happen in the days and weeks ahead? Because this conversation is happening pretty rapidly.
The speed in which it's happening, I mean, I think that there's always the possibility that within a week, the status quo rolls on again. I mean, it's durable for a reason. But I do think that we are seeing it's leaving the sports world. And anytime that happens, I think that there are really good opportunities to build forward.
There's the attitude among fans that you should just be grateful you have this job, and you should be grateful and you should just do what you're told. And I hope that's going to finally start to turn, and that the athletes will feel that they have power, they have support. To the extent that players feel support from media and fans, they'll be more inclined to start to take some power back.
Professor Amira Rose Davis, author of the forthcoming book, Can't Eat a Medal, The Lives and Labors of Black Women Athletes in the Age of Jim Crow, and sports commentator for NBCSports.com, Mike Florio. Thank you both for this conversation.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
In Texas and North Carolina, Memphis and St. Louis, and maybe even in your own backyard, it is barbecue season. And in that spirit, today we're going to drop in on Kansas City to learn more about Henry Perry. They called him the Barbecue King, and back in March, Mackenzie Martin from member station KCUR brought us the story of this black entrepreneur from a century ago who created an American institution. Today, we'll get a second helping.
One of the first things you should know about Henry Perry is that he didn't get the name Barbecue King posthumously. He called himself the Barbecue King. He put it in newspaper ads. It was on the window of his restaurant. Perry also didn't create barbecue in Kansas City. People were already barbecuing meat when he arrived in 1907 from Memphis. He was just the first guy to really make a living selling it, and he coined the local style. To many, the reason for his success was pretty simple.
He smoked barbecue better than anybody. And they traveled from as far as Leavenworth, Kansas, just to eat his food.
In spite of it being the Jim Crow era, Kansas City historians like Sonny Gibson say Perry's various restaurants in the black neighborhood surrounding 18th and Vine attracted a diverse customer base.
You could walk in through the front door, you would see black and white people. It was a place where segregation ended when you walked through the door.
It's not like barbecue was the great unifier, but like jazz at the time, Perry's was a place where black and white people coexisted in ways they weren't doing elsewhere. According to Perry, there was only one way to cook barbecue, slow, over a fire made from hickory and oak wood, with the meat juices dripping on the coals. But while Perry was picky about how he barbecued, he wasn't picky about what he barbecued.
He barbecued and he cooked everything. Raccoons, coons, rabbits.
Possum, hog, mutton. Based on what we know, though, we can safely assume that all of it was pretty tasty, right?
Aren't you a little curious what it would taste like?
No. No, I'm not curious. No way. Ain't nobody gonna eat no barbecue raccoon.
Well, there's at least one person.
I've eaten coon before. It has a real pleasant taste, coon does.
Jim Watts is the ombudsman at the Black Archives of Mid-America Research Center here in Kansas City. He credits Perry's marketing and business savvy with what got people to come from all over.
Perry was the guy that stood up, wanted to make a living doing something that he liked doing. He was a businessman.
And Perry's influence didn't end when he died in 1940. In a sense, his influence tripled. See, there were three notable apprentices that Henry Perry taught about barbecue: Arthur Pinkard, and brothers Arthur and Charlie Bryant. Pinkard went on to cook for what is now the Gates Family Barbecue chain. Meanwhile, the Bryant brothers, first Charlie, then Arthur, went on to create the business we know today as Arthur Bryant's. They all credited Henry Perry with teaching them everything they knew about slow-cooking meat. But in spite of helping kickstart two of Kansas City's most famous barbecue restaurants, very few Kansas Cityans know the story of Henry Perry. That includes his own descendants.
I am Bernetta McKendra, and I am the granddaughter of Henry Perry.
McKendra never met her grandfather, and she didn't grow up hearing stories about him from her mother or her grandmother.
He just wasn't talked about. It was just known that he was the barbecue king.
Then a few years ago, McKendra happened to overhear someone talking about how Henry Perry had been inducted into the American Royal Barbecue Hall of Fame. It spurred her to start researching the grandfather she never knew.
And it was not until I started to read and got older and saw other publications that I began to know that, oh, I think he really is someone.
McKendra says last summer was when it really sunk in that her grandfather was someone special. That's when Henry Perry Day was proclaimed in Kansas City, exactly a century after he fed 1,000 Kansas Cityans for free on the lawn next to his restaurant.
It was a glorious time. It was really a time of reckoning that not only was this man being recognized, but he also was my blood relative. The thing that's been most interesting to me is his tenacity. What was the drive that kept him going?
Today, there isn't a Perry's Barbecue in downtown Kansas City, but there's Gates and Arthur Bryant's in the old 18th and Vine Jazz District. And not far away, there's Joe's, Jones, LC's, Jack Stack, Q39, and countless others. Kansas City barbecue joints, some of which might not be around today if it wasn't for Henry Perry. And while they might not cook the meat directly on the coals like Perry did, they're still carrying on his tradition of barbecue excellence in Kansas City. For Here and Now, I'm Mackenzie Martin.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.